Random House Audio presents The Hidden Brain. How our unconscious minds elect presidents, control markets, wage wars, and save our lives. By Shankar Vaithantham. Read for you by Steve West. Introduction. In the spring of 2004, The Washington Post assigned me to track Ralph Nader in New England as he campaigned for president. When I got to Boston, several of Nader's own aides, mindful of the consumer advocate's role as spoiler in the disputed 2000 election between George W. Bush and Al Gore, told me they were going to vote against him. Since Nader's campaign was going nowhere, I took a break from the political story and called a local psychologist I'd heard about. Mazarine Banaji agreed to meet me on short notice. We met in the afternoon at her corner office in Harvard University's psychology department. It was an extraordinary interview. When I left, 3 hours later, the whole world looked different. Banaji studied unconscious prejudices, subtle cognitive errors that lay beneath the rim of awareness. Her research disturbed me because it showed that the way we usually think about human behavior is flawed. Volunteers in Banaji's experiments believed they were acting fairly, honorably, and wisely, but their actions were at odds with their intentions. They meant to do one thing, but did something else. Strangely, until a psychological test revealed the discrepancy, the volunteers were not aware that they had been subtly biased. If unconscious forces could influence us when we made swift judgments about other people, could these forces influence us all the time? Upon returning to Washington, I quickly found research that showed how hidden tugs cause people to make grave financial errors and misjudgments about risk. Experiments were showing that voters could be manipulated into choosing one candidate over another, without the voters ever realizing they were manipulated. Unconscious traits explained why some married couples drifted apart and why some teams worked well together. Everywhere I looked, I found evidence of hidden cognitive mechanisms. Unconscious biases in the way memory, emotion, and attention work produced misunderstandings and protracted conflicts between people, groups, even nations. Subtle errors of the mind could explain why we have rushed into foolish wars and why we have sat on our hands as genocides unfolded. Banaji was a social psychologist, but streams of intersecting data about a hidden world in our head were flowing in from other branches of psychology, from sociology and political science, from economics and neuroscience. High-tech scans are revealing brain mechanisms that governed everything from our political preferences to our table manners. Sociological experiments explained why people unconsciously made fatal mistakes during disasters. There was even research into the unconscious biases of suicide bombers. Most people equate the term unconscious bias with prejudice or partiality, but the new research was using the term differently. Unconscious bias described any situation where people's actions were at odds with their intentions. The devilish thing was that people never felt manipulated. They rationalized their biases away and even claimed ownership for actions they had not intended. Some unconscious biases were comical, others were innocuous. Many were useful. But the deadly ones conjured a Shakespearean image in my mind, the demonic Iago manipulating the gullible Othello into believing his wife was unfaithful. Like Iago, unconscious bias influenced people subtly, not overtly. It caused them to make serious errors of judgment and then feel certain about their conclusions. It derived much of its power from the fact that people were unaware of it. Theories about the unconscious mind went back centuries, but the new research appealed to me because it was based on measurable evidence. It relied on controlled experiments. It produced data. As a science journalist at the Washington Post, and before that at the Philadelphia Inquirer, I found myself attracted to research that explored complex social behavior using the tools of rigorous science. Where previous accounts of the unconscious mind often produced dramatic theories with limited impact, The new research was producing modest theories about the mind, but they had dramatic impact. In writing a Washington Post column called Department of Human Behavior that I launched in 2006, I learned that one reason unconscious biases were difficult to spot is that they were often mundane. When we saw something as monstrous as genocide, we wanted an explanation that was equally dramatic. We demanded Hitler's to explain Holocausts. Dramatic explanations didn't just fit better, they allowed us to write off systematic errors in human judgment, perception, and moral reasoning as mere aberrations. I saw that a vast gulf had grown between what experts were learning about the mind and what most people believed. Important institutions in our society were oblivious to the new research. When disasters trapped thousands, we widened the exits to tall buildings and assumed this would allow people trapped by future disasters to escape. When discrimination reared its head, we passed hate crime laws. When the stock markets acted crazy, we blamed unreasonable panic. We believed that frightening teenagers about the consequences of drugs and unsafe sex would prompt them to be careful. We assumed that fact-checking the tall claims of politicians would set the record straight. And we were sure that good laws produced good behavior. All these theories were based on an assumption that human behavior was the product of knowledge and conscious intention. We believed that if you educated people and provided them with accurate information and offered them the right incentives and threatened them with suitable punishments and appealed to their better natures and marked the exits clearly, the errors would vanish. Bad outcomes had to be the product of stupidity, ignorance, and bad intentions. Like many assumptions, this one was impervious to contradictory evidence. When teenagers got drunk and wrecked their cars, when voters believed a politician's lies, and when juries convicted innocent people, we invariably concluded that those particular teens must have been stupid, that those particular voters must have been gullible, and that those particular juries must have been rash. Even when such errors were multiplied hundreds or thousands of times, when large numbers of people failed to flee disasters, when entire ethnic groups subscribed to vicious prejudices, when millions failed to intervene as their neighbors were dragged off to concentration camps, we convinced ourselves that these behaviors were aberrational, not the norm. The new research showed that many errors, mishaps, and tragedies were caused by unconscious forces that acted upon people without their awareness or consent. The irresponsible driver, the apathetic bystander, and the panicked investor were not aberrations. They were us. Thinking about human behavior in the context of unconscious bias explained many things to me that previously seemed inexplicable. It wasn't just the small stuff, the gifted athlete who choked under pressure, the family feud over something trivial, the misjudgment in risk that produced a fender bender. It was the big stuff, too. The uncritical decisions of policymakers that led to domestic and foreign policy catastrophes? Check. The stampeding panics that dragged entire economies to ruin? Check. The collective willingness of nations to avert their gaze from oncoming disasters? That too. Unconscious biases have always dogged us, but multiple factors make them especially dangerous today. Globalization and technology, and the intersecting fault lines of religious extremism, economic upheaval, demographic change, and mass migration have amplified the effects of hidden biases. Our mental errors once affected only ourselves and those in our vicinity. Today, they affect people in distant lands and generations yet unborn. The flapping butterfly that caused a hurricane halfway around the world was a theoretical construct. Today, subtle biases in faraway minds produce real storms in our lives. This book grew out of these thoughts. I wanted to place the ideas that I found so exciting, unnerving, and provocative before a larger audience. If science and rigorous studies were to be the backbone of the book, I wanted to show why the research mattered, not just in the ivory tower, but in the public square. I decided to find stories from real life that could illustrate the extraordinary effects of unconscious bias in everyday life. The selection of stories in this book is mine and mine alone. To the extent that they are wrong, misleading, or simplistic, the responsibility lies solely with me. To the extent that they are revealing and insightful, and not merely interesting, the credit mostly belongs to the hundreds of researchers whose work I have cited. I made a deliberate decision to personify the hidden forces that influence us in everyday life. I coined a term, the hidden brain. It did not refer to a secret agent inside our skulls or some recently unearthed brain module. The hidden brain was shorthand for a range of influences that manipulated us without our awareness. Some aspects of the hidden brain had to do with a pervasive problem of mental shortcuts or heuristics. Others were related to errors in the way memory and attention worked. Some dealt with social dynamics and relationships. What was common to them all was that we were unaware of their influence. There were dimensions of the hidden brain where, with effort, we could become aware of our biases, but there were many aspects of the hidden brain that were permanently sealed off from introspection. Unconscious bias was not caused by a secret puppeteer who sat inside our heads, but the effects of bias were as though such a puppeteer existed. The hidden brain, in other words, was a writing device, much like the selfish gene. Just as there were no strands of DNA that shouted, "Me first," no part of the human brain was disguised under sunglasses and fedora. By drawing a simple line between mental activities we were aware of and mental activities we were not aware of, the hidden brain subsumed many concepts in wide circulation whose definitions were frequently the subject of dissension: the unconscious, the subconscious, the implicit. If my debt to the researchers whose work I have cited is immense, my debt to those who shared personal stories with me is incalculable. Many stories in this book describe the effects of unconscious bias on people during moments of great vulnerability. The opening chapter is about a woman who made a serious error identifying the man who raped her. It is a story I would have preferred not to tell. Journalistic accounts of rape are troubling for many reasons, but sex crimes offer a powerful window into unconscious bias because they allow us to measure the accuracy of human intuitions against the iron rigor of DNA tests. I doubt I would have had the courage to share the story that Toni Gustas shared with me. Her honesty and the honesty of many others in this book reminded me of a great truth. Good people are not those who lack flaws. The brave are not those who feel no fear. And the generous are not those who never feel selfish. Extraordinary people are not extraordinary because they are invulnerable to unconscious biases. They are extraordinary because they choose to do something about it. Chapter 1. The Myth of Intention. 5 days before her 30th birthday, on August 24, 1986, Toni Gustas was out on her patio. It was a Sunday, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and Gustas was in a t-shirt working on some plants. She had just moved to Massachusetts from Iowa. The only contact she had in town was a person who had hired her for a job at the United Way in Framingham. She had found a small two-bedroom basement apartment with a living room that opened onto a sunken patio. When she stood on the patio, the street came up to her chest. A man strolled by and asked for directions. His eyes seemed glassy and his speech was slurred. Gustas did not know how to direct the man, but her Midwestern upbringing kept her from giving a curt answer and turning away. She told him she was new in town and unsure of the local geography. She pointed him in a direction she thought might be helpful. The man did not turn away. He took another step toward the patio and asked if a different street could take him to the same place. She told him what she knew, but she was starting to feel uncomfortable. It was as if they were suddenly having a conversation. The man took another step to the edge of the patio. Gustas told the man she had to go inside. She turned, and he jumped down onto the patio. He grabbed her arm. She raised her voice immediately and told him to leave. He asked for a glass of water. Gustas could smell alcohol on his breath. She protested, and he started to shove her back into the apartment. A driver in a passing car saw a man and a woman having what seemed to be an altercation on a patio. The driver went to the corner, turned around, and came back for another look. By the time the car got back to the spot, the patio was empty. The driver moved on. The intruder was not much taller than Gustus. She was about 5'5", and he may have been 5'9" or 5'10", but he was considerably stronger. The moment he shoved her into the apartment, she started fighting. She screamed, and he clamped a hand over her mouth. He was carrying a portable music player, and Gustus seized the headphones cord and wound it around his neck. He seized her throat. They struggled, trying to subdue each other, until Gustus felt she was going to pass out. Something more primal than fear kicked in. Gustus let go of the headphones cord and went passive. It wasn't just that he was stronger. He was so drunk that she feared he might asphyxiate her and not even know it. No matter what happened, she wanted to get out alive. The moment he started removing her clothes, another instinct kicked in. Gustus started to memorize details about the man. He was white and in his early 20s. He had a little black cross on one arm that may have been ink or may have been a tattoo. He had dark blonde hair that fell over his forehead and his ears. His hair was parted in the middle. His nose was long in proportion to his face. His eyes were blue and relatively narrow. He had a tapered jaw. On and on she went, looking for distinctive features. She swore to herself, "I am not going to forget this face." After he raped her, the man allowed her to dress. He put on his clothes. He was not done. It appeared he wanted to have a conversation. Gustus could not believe he wanted small talk. In a sympathetic voice, he told her that sometimes it is not good for women when it is like this. Gustus was stunned. He had no idea what he had just done. He was subdued for now, but who knew how long it would last? Screaming for help was out of the question. She had tried that, and no one had responded. She had to get out of the apartment. Calmly keeping up her end of the small talk, she told the rapist she needed a glass of water from the kitchen. She asked if he wanted a glass too. He did nothing to stop her from walking out of the living room. The door to the apartment was next to the kitchen, and Gustus simply opened the door and kept walking. A strange calm descended upon her. She knew what she had to do. From a drugstore, she called her boss and told him what had happened. He drove by, picked her up, and took her to the police station. Police officers administered a rape kit and immediately asked Gustus to tell them everything distinctive about the rapist. Gustus unloaded every detail she had memorized about the man, the nose, the chin, the eyes, the hair. The man had been wearing a blue and white shirt, a blue windbreaker, and jeans. An artist came up with a composite picture that Gustus thought was fairly accurate. She told the police the man's voice was slurred, but she was good with voices and had memorized how he sounded. By the time the police arrived at the crime scene, the rapist was gone, but he had left his windbreaker behind. There was a burrito wrapped in plastic and foil inside one pocket. Police officers traced it to a convenience store. There was a black and white film security camera in the store, and the police showed Gustus the grainy video. She recognized the rapist the moment she saw him, even though the tape did not show his face. Gustus had memorized the man's body language, the way he carried himself. The police showed her photos of a number of possible suspects and pictures from local high school yearbooks. None of the photos matched the rapist. About a month after the crime, the police asked Gustus if a drifter they had picked up was the man. Gustus said no. In early December, the police picked up a man who matched the composite picture. Late one evening, police detectives brought Gustus a set of 15 photos. Gustus pointed to the photo of the man the police had picked up, but she said she needed to see him before she could be sure. Through a one-way mirror at the police station, Gustus thought she saw the rapist. She was cautious by nature and asked if she could hear the man's voice. The police held a door ajar so Gustus could hear the suspect speak. Gustus told the police she was 95% sure that the man in custody was the rapist. His name, she learned, was Eric Sarsfield. Gusta spent Christmas that year with her family in a small Illinois town across the Iowa border. She had thought a lot about Sarsfield in the days after she had identified him. She was quite certain he was a rapist, but was worried about the sliver of doubt at the back of her mind. Gustus was the sort of person who took responsibility for everything. No matter the situation, she asked herself what she had done wrong or what she could have done better. Was her sliver of uncertainty only a manifestation of this trait to doubt herself? There was a Presbyterian church in town that Gustus had long known. It was a place of refuge and comfort. She was a person of faith, and the church always renewed her. She used to sing in the choir, and the choir director had been her voice teacher. Sitting in the safe space of the church, ensconced by family, Gusta suddenly felt the burden of doubt lift from her shoulders. She was not 95% sure that Eric Sarsfield was the rapist. She was 100% certain. She testified against Sarsfield. When asked how certain she was that the man sitting in the defendant's chair was the rapist, Gustus said she was sure. The defense, of course, pointed out that Gustus had initially not been certain, but there were many things about Gustus and the crime that made her testimony compelling. She had seen her assailant for an hour in broad daylight on a sunny day. She was an extraordinarily diligent witness with a keen memory for every distinctive detail about the rapist. Her trustworthiness was unimpeachable, her caution exemplary. She was not the kind of person to say Sarsfield was guilty if she had the slightest doubt. Sarsfield pleaded innocent, but that did not mean much. Gustus told herself that it was possible he had no recollection of the crime because he had been so drunk. The jury was out for several days. As usual, Gustus took responsibility for the delay. She remonstrated with herself for being so cautious at first. She was now afraid that the doubt she had initially expressed would cause the jury to set free a dangerous man, a rapist who would go on to harm other women. She wanted to see Sarsfield convicted and put behind bars. In the end, when the jury found him guilty, Gustus felt a tremendous relief. The months since the crime had been terribly difficult, and she wanted to move on with her life. She put the case out of her mind. Over time, she learned that Sarsfield had appealed his conviction, that he'd been turned down, and that he had gone to prison. Gustus got married and settled down. In 2000, 14 years after the crime, Gustus received a letter from the district attorney in Middlesex County. It said new evidence had come to light in the case and asked her to come in for a chat. The letter instantly triggered doubts and dread. Gustus turned to her husband and said, "Oh my God, something has happened and it's not really him." She learned that a DNA test had been conducted using the rape kit that the police had administered on the day of the crime. The test showed that Sarsfield could not have been the rapist. Gustus did not know much about DNA and was full of questions. She spent half her time blaming herself for not taking her initial sliver of doubt seriously, and the other half wondering about the accuracy of DNA tests. She had a talk with a friend who knew about the science of genetic testing and reassured herself that the test was accurate and had been conducted by a reputable laboratory. But her doubts persisted. She had seen what she had seen. She would never have testified against Sarsfield if she had not been sure he was the rapist. She had gone 14 years being certain that Sarsfield was guilty. About a year later, a lawyer got in touch with Gustus to ask if she wanted to meet a client, Eric Sarsfield. The lawyer assured her that Sarsfield bore her no ill will and had forgiven her for misidentifying him. Gustus was not sure about a meeting. For one thing, she was still unconvinced that Sarsfield was innocent. But if the test was right and she was wrong, that was horrible too. An innocent man had spent years in prison, while the real rapist had gone scot-free. Some 13 years of Sarsfield's life had been erased. It wasn't just the time he'd spent behind bars. Sarsfield had suffered terribly at the hands of guards and other inmates. He was not just broken physically, he was a mental wreck. Gustus went into therapy to work out her fears and confusions. Finally, She consented to a meeting with Sarsfield, but insisted it be on her terms. Her husband would accompany her, and the meeting would take place in her therapist's office. When Eric Sarsfield showed up, he brought his fiancée and his lawyer. The moment they greeted each other, Gusta saw something she had not seen before in Eric Sarsfield. Not at the police station when she'd initially identified him through a one-way mirror, not when police had held a door ajar so she could hear his voice, and not in court when he'd sat silently before her as she testified. What she saw convinced her that she had made a terrible mistake. Gustus had had crooked teeth as a child and had worn braces. Teeth were something she noticed. The rapist had had even teeth. Gustus had not mentioned this to the police, and they hadn't asked, because everyone had been trying so hard to focus on things about the rapist that were distinctive. There was nothing distinctive about the rapist's teeth. The moment Eric Sarsfield opened his mouth to say hello, the first thing Gustus noticed was that he had crooked teeth. The story of Tony Gustus and Eric Sarsfield is a story about multiple tragedies. Gustus was a blameless victim who mistakenly sent the wrong man to prison. Sarsfield was traumatized for having been wrongly incarcerated, but there was a third victim too. All of us. The man who raped Gustus was never apprehended. He may have harmed others and may do so again. The tragedies illustrate the immense consequences of unconscious bias in our lives. Tony Gustus made a mistake, but it was not an error based in malice or hatred. It was an unintentional error of the mind. Her testimony and her confidence that she had identified the right person were truly powerful. The jury that convicted Sarsfield made a mistake too, but it was not a mistake caused by recklessness or ill will. In hindsight, we know the jury underweighted the doubt Gustus initially had and ignored problematic aspects of the case. Sarsfield had been drinking the night Gustus identified him, and the slurred voice she heard through the door that the police held ajar may have sounded more like the rapist's than it would have otherwise. The police may have subtly prompted Gustus to finger Sarsfield as they showed her the photo array. But asked to choose between a compelling eyewitness and data that did not quite add up, the jury trusted the emotional testimony of an eyewitness who said she was certain about what she saw. The case highlights the most distinguishing characteristic of the biases that are the subject of this book. We are not aware of their existence. The endless photos that the police showed Gustus after the crime weakened her memory of her rapist, even though it did not feel that way to her. Her relief at being home with family and in her church soothed away her doubts, even though she felt she was being rigorous. As Gustus diligently recounted the rapist's features, she ignored a crucial detail, even though she felt she had reported everything. The police and prosecutors believed Sarsfield was guilty and failed to think critically about their conclusions. The jury got swept up. Everyone was wrong, but no one felt anything was wrong. Gustus desperately wanted to get things right. It is particularly instructive that she remembers the precise moment when her doubts vanished. In the safe sanctuary of her church, she exhaled and told herself, "It is him." There is abundant research showing that our mood states, comfort and peace, anger and envy, influence our memory and judgment. Gustus's doubt about Sarsfield was a source of discomfort. The church offered Gustus comfort. The two things had nothing to do with each other, except that it is impossible to feel both comfort and discomfort at the same time. Discomfort, not comfort, was Gustus's real friend in the situation. By soothing it away, she erased the signal she had that something was wrong. Instead of attending to the fire, she unintentionally disabled the fire alarm. It is also instructive that both Gustus and the police focused on distinctive details about the rapist while ignoring the routine. Unconscious algorithms in the brain prompt people to pay more attention to the unusual, a tattoo or a voice, than to the everyday. The one physical feature that could have distinguished the rapist from Sarsfield, his teeth, was discarded not because it was hidden from view, but because it was too ordinary to mention. What happened to Tony Gustus is not an aberration. the influence that emotions wield over judgment and countless other cognitive biases surfaces repeatedly in multiple dimensions of our lives. These biases affect everything from how we form personal relationships and make investments to how we deal with terrorism and war. If it doesn't feel that way, it is because the central feature of unconscious bias is that we are not aware of it. We think of ourselves as rational, deliberate creatures. We know why we like this movie star rather than that, this president or that television anchor. Just ask, and we can tell you why this political party has all the right answers and that one does not. Our daily actions always seem to have clear reasons behind them. We brush our teeth so we don't get cavities. We hit the brakes to stop our cars. And we get upset when someone cuts in line because that is unfair. Scientists have long known that there are many brain activities that lie outside the ken of conscious awareness. Your brain regulates your heart, keeps you breathing, and makes you turn over in your sleep at night. None of these things feel strange or disturbing. We are perfectly happy to delegate such mundane chores to what? To some hidden part of our brain that does all that boring stuff. If we ask ourselves what portion of our mental world is conscious and deliberate, and what portion lies outside our awareness, it feels as though most of our mental activity lies within the bright circle of conscious thought. Even a cursory examination of this theory, however, suggests flaws. You have no awareness, for example, of how your brain takes visual images from the page of a book, translating symbols into recognizable letters, combining the letters into words and sentences, and producing meaning. All you, meaning your conscious brain, must do is decide to read, and the rest flows seamlessly. You know your brain must be doing all those things, but you have no awareness of it. Similarly, when I ask you your name, you are not aware of how your conscious brain retrieves Jack, or Susan, or Barack. You know the answer, but you don't know how you know the answer. Okay, we tell ourselves. So reading and other everyday activities involve aspects of brain functioning that we aren't fully aware of. But we are still aware of most of what our minds do, certainly all the things that are important. By important, we mean the activities of higher thought, the conversations we have or the way we reach our opinions. Let's think about some of those things. Take the last conversation you had with that quarrelsome neighbor. As usual, he said something that set you off. It is clear his words upset you, but were you really aware of what was going on in your brain as you lost your temper? One moment you were pruning a hedge, the next you felt blood rushing to your temples and hot words were springing from your mouth. It was almost automatic. But if you didn't consciously decide to get angry, where did the anger come from? Or let's consider something more pleasant. You see someone across a crowded room, and your eyes connect. Your breath catches. Where did the feeling of attraction come from? You didn't make a list of the person's features, compare it against a list of your own preferences, and decide you were attracted. No, it happened in an instant. You locked eyes, and, without knowing why, your heart lurched. All right, we say. So we are not always deliberate when it comes to emotions. But that's because they are emotions. They are supposed to be messy and ill-defined. That still leaves lots of room for conscious thought. There are many situations where we are completely aware of what we do. We decide to invest in a stock after a careful analysis of the market. We hire a job candidate based on a careful analysis of her qualifications. In recent years, a number of experiments have demonstrated that these intuitions are also flawed. Overweight job applicants, to cite just one example, are widely perceived to be less intelligent and successful, and lazier and more immoral, than identically qualified people of normal weight. In an unusual demonstration of this bias, psychologist Michelle Hebel once sat a job applicant in a waiting room with volunteers who were to later decide whether to hire the applicant. In some cases, volunteers saw the applicant sitting alone. In other cases, volunteers saw the applicant sitting next to a person of average weight, and a third group saw him sitting next to someone who was overweight. When the job applicant sat next to someone overweight, he was later perceived to have lower professional and interpersonal skills and deemed less worthy of hire, compared to when he sat alone in the waiting room or next to a person of average weight. Without their awareness, volunteers were not only penalizing overweight people, but someone who was merely in the vicinity of an overweight person. Intersecting lines of scientific research show that even in higher kinds of thinking, hidden forces often sit beside us and subtly pull us in one direction or another. These biases do not influence only the uneducated and the irresponsible. It is difficult to imagine an eyewitness more thorough, more diligent, and more responsible than Tony Gustus. The discovery of a world of unconscious cognitive biases has come about much in the manner of an archaeological dig. Researchers scraping beneath the bright circle of conscious thought slowly came to realize that the circle was really a hole that sat atop another structure. The deeper they dug, the more they uncovered, until they eventually found an entire pyramid of unconscious brain activity. Discoveries about a hidden world in our heads have come so fast and have spanned so many aspects of human functioning that it has prompted some very smart people to ask an astonishing question. Not, why do we have a hidden brain, but why do we have a conscious brain? To understand where this question comes from, imagine you are standing at the base of the newly excavated pyramid. If you crane your neck, you can see the aperture of light at the top. The circle of conscious awareness you once thought encompassed everything. As you draw your gaze back, the aperture grows tiny and you see more and more of the superstructure beneath it. At a certain point, you stop asking why there is a hidden pyramid below the apex of conscious awareness and start asking why the pyramid needs a hole at the top. There are many explanations for why we have a conscious brain and a hidden brain. One is that we regularly encounter two kinds of experiences, those that are novel and those that are familiar. The conscious mind excels in novel situations because it is rational, careful, analytical. But once a problem has been understood and the rules to solve it discovered, it makes no sense to think through the problem afresh every time you encounter it. You apply the rules you have learned and move on. This is the dimension in which the hidden brain excels. It is a master of heuristics, the mental shortcuts we use to carry out the mundane chores of life. Learning most skills is really about teaching your hidden brain a set of rules. When you first learn to ride a bicycle, you pay conscious attention to how far you can lean to one side before you topple over. Once you master the rules of how gravity, balance, and momentum interact, your conscious brain relegates bike riding to the hidden brain. You no longer have to think about what you are doing. It becomes automatic. When you first learn a language, you approach it deliberately. But once you master the language, you don't have to consciously think about retrieving the right word or coming up with the correct syntax. It becomes automatic. The conscious brain is slow and deliberate. It learns from textbooks and understands how rules have exceptions. The hidden brain is designed to be fast, to make quick approximations and instant adjustments. Right now, your hidden brain is doing many more things than your conscious brain could attend to with the same efficiency. The hidden brain sacrifices sophistication to achieve speed. Since your hidden brain values speed over accuracy, it regularly applies heuristics to situations where they do not work. It is as though you master a mental shortcut while riding a bicycle, bunch your fingers into a fist to clench the brakes, and apply the heuristic when you are driving a car. You clutch the steering wheel when you need to stop, instead of jamming your foot on the brake. Now imagine the problem on a grander scale, the hidden brain applying all kinds of rules to complex situations where they do not apply. When you show people the faces of two political candidates and ask them to judge who looks more competent based only on appearance, people usually have no trouble picking one face over the other. Not only that, but they will tell you, if they are Democrats, that the person who looks more competent is probably a Democrat. If they are Republicans, There is just something about that competent face that looks Republican. Everyone knows it is absurd to leap to conclusions about competence based on appearance. So why do people have a feeling about one face or another? It's because their hidden brain knows what competent people look like. The job of the hidden brain is to leap to conclusions. This is why people cannot tell you why one politician looks more competent than another, or why one job candidate seems more qualified than another. They just have a feeling, an intuition. The idea that what seems conscious and intentional might actually be the product of unconscious forces echoes through history from Plato to Freud to Hollywood. In Plato's famous cave, prisoners who see nothing but shadows all their lives come to believe that the shadows are real. It is only when the prisoners emerge from the cave into sunlight that they see the difference between reality and unreality. Plato's liberated prisoners experience an epiphany. Freud aimed to give his patients a similar bolt of insight when they realized how their lives had been circumscribed by some long-ago trauma. In The Matrix, Hollywood asked if our actions were subtly controlled by hidden puppeteers who are robots. When Keanu Reeves's character squinted his eyes, he was able to see streaming three-dimensional structures of ones and zeros, which is how Hollywood conceptualized the world of robotic control. In all these cases, an aha moment brings the walls crashing down, as people realize they have been manipulated. I might as well admit something. You will never see the working of your hidden brain this way. The disbelief you may feel when you hear that your everyday actions are routinely influenced by things outside your conscious awareness cannot be erased by any amount of evidence. No matter how much you learn about the hidden brain, you will never feel it manipulating you. No Keanu Reeves can help you. You are permanently stuck inside this matrix, because that is the way your brain is designed. To become otherwise does not mean liberation. It is to become something other than fully human. Like you, I am stuck inside the matrix. I feel I have reasons for the things I do. I am certain about the conclusions I reach. Like you, I'm offended if anyone tells me that I do not know my own mind. And like you, I dismiss as absurd the idea that even my perceptions, my basic abilities to see and hear, are regularly swayed by the machinations of my hidden brain. In the course of reporting and of writing this book, I have learned that all those things are true, but they still don't feel true. When a magician performs an illusion, people strain to see through the deception. Implicit in this effort is the belief that illusions are always out there. You enjoy a magic show because illusions are supposed to be different from the stuff of reality. But what if they aren't? What if we are being constantly fooled, tricked, and hoodwinked, not by some actor dressed in a cape, but by our own brain? And which is the more successful illusion, the one that ends with a bow and applause, or the one that feels so real we never stop to think about it? The shift in understanding about human behavior has been quiet, but its implications are seismic. Nearly all our social, political, and economic institutions are based on an assumption of how human beings behave that is at best incomplete and at worst fundamentally wrong. We see evidence for this all the time in the ways our institutions, governments, and economic systems fail us, in the endlessly recursive conflicts that nations and peoples have with one another, in the most dreadful moral disasters that humans have perpetrated on one another or that humans have ignored. Our incomplete understanding of human behavior causes us to make errors in our personal lives, in the way we choose partners and the way we behave as consumers, and in the way we respond to politicians and to warnings of disaster. These errors pervade the criminal justice system and they poison the workplace. The mistakes are so fundamental to the way we think about the world that we have enshrined them in international treaties and in constitutions. Our vulnerability to unconscious manipulation explains how a few schemers can hold entire political systems hostage. It explains failures of national and global resolve in dealing with challenges as serious as climate change. It explains tragedies such as genocide that seem aberrational each time they occur, but that repeat themselves with monotonous regularity. Evidence for the hidden brain is really all around us, hidden in plain sight. The clues pervade our lives, the choices we make, our moral judgments. Our blindness to bias seems willful, until you remember that the central feature of unconscious bias is that it is unconscious. The new understanding of human behavior constitutes a revolution no less intriguing, and perhaps more powerful, than the discovery that Newton's laws of motion collapse at the level of quantum mechanics, or that the sun really does not revolve around the earth, or that human beings appeared on the earth as the result of a logical but impersonal force called natural selection. Just as it once seemed inconceivable that an object can be in two places at the same time, or that the movement of the sun across the sky is an illusion caused by the earth rotating in the opposite direction, or that whales and cows are distant cousins, so also it seems inconceivable that much of our lives takes place outside the boundaries of our own awareness. The extraordinary new discoveries about the hidden world in our heads feel personal, moreover, in a way those other fantastic conclusions do not. If you now feel as I once did when I first began learning about these ideas, you might even be a little offended that anyone would say you have a very limited understanding of what is happening in your own head, that the feeling of common sense we all experience is an illusion no less fake and far more spectacular than the sun's daily journey across the sky. The ideas in this book are organized into concentric circles, with the early chapters detailing small and sometimes humorous examples of the hidden brain at work, and later chapters tackling bigger issues. Chapter 2 shows the hidden brain at work in four diverse settings: at an office beverage station in England, on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, at a restaurant in the Netherlands, and in a scientific laboratory in Philadelphia. Chapter 3 demonstrates how the hidden brain influences everything from table manners to the unwritten rules of flirting, and the extraordinary consequences that breakdowns in the hidden brain can have on our lives. Chapter 4 explains how the hidden brain produces stereotypes in the minds of small children, and the continuing effects such stereotypes have on adult behavior and relationships. Chapter 5 explores the world of unconscious sexism. Chapters 6 and 7 explore the unconscious influence that groups wield in highly charged situations. Chapter 6 is about the effects that large groups wield over people during disasters, and Chapter 7 is about the power that small groups have in shaping extreme behavior such as suicide terrorism. Chapter 8 looks at the effects of unconscious prejudice in the criminal justice system, and Chapter 9 examines the role of the hidden brain in politics. Chapter 10 explores how unconscious factors influence our perceptions of risk and our moral judgment, and affect policies that touch the lives of millions. Chapter 2. The Ubiquitous Shadow. The Hidden Brain at Work and Play. Unconscious bias reaches into every corner of your life. At any given time, many dimensions of your hidden brain are at work. Some cooperate with one another, others clash. What is common to all the actions of the hidden brain is the modesty with which it works. Like an attentive assistant that knows you better than you know yourself, the hidden brain anticipates your needs but claims no credit for laying out your shirt, choosing your tie, or making your coffee. That is a wonderful convenience when tasks are mundane and heuristics are applied appropriately. It's when things go wrong, when heuristics are applied in error, or when the hidden brain makes an association that doesn't quite work, that we find ourselves asking, "What was I doing?" or "What was I thinking?" It happens to all of us. There are times when our actions are so at odds with our conscious beliefs and intentions that we don't quite know why we laughed aloud when someone made a mean-spirited joke, or why we lashed out in anger at someone we love. We can't explain why we set the alarm to go off at 6 p.m. instead of 6 a.m., or why we hit the gas pedal when we meant to hit the brake. We don't know why we choked during a big test, or were tongue-tied when it came to standing up for ourselves in a dispute. Why didn't I say something? We wonder afterward. Why did I do that? How could I have been so foolish? This chapter aims to show how widely the effects of unconscious bias touch our everyday lives. The examples that follow are drawn from disparate domains and show the hidden brain at work in a private setting, a professional setting, a social setting, and an intimate setting. The spotlight effect. The beverage station was located in a nondescript office in Newcastle in northeastern England. It was no different from thousands of other office stations where tea, coffee, and milk were dispensed using an honour system. A sheet of paper was posted on a cupboard door at eye level. Under the banner of a small photograph, the notice specified the cost of tea, 30 pence, coffee, 50 pence, and milk, 10 pence. People assembled their beverages and dropped money in an honour box. An office maven sent out emails every 6 months or so, reminding people to pay for their beverages. But like many other office stations, this one was located in a spot where people could not be observed. If they were honest and paid for their tea and coffee, no one gave them a pat on the back. If they did not pay, no one caught them. The setup had been in place for several years. Recently, without the knowledge of the several dozen people who used the beverage station, a researcher named Melissa Bateson started tracking how much milk was dispensed each week. She also counted the money in the honour box. She did both things for 10 weeks. You would think the money collected would be roughly the same from week to week, especially if the office workers drank the same amount of tea and coffee. In the first and eighth week, in late January and mid-March, people drank the same amount of milk. But the honour box in the first week held £8.25. In the eighth week, it held £1.17, 7 times less. Did people decide to be more honest at the start? No. Employees did not know Bateson was studying their honesty. Besides, the money collected in the ninth week, in late March, was more than double the amount collected in the second week of the experiment, in early February. During half the study, weeks 1, 3, 5, 7, and 9, Bateson collected 3 times as much as she did during weeks 2, 4, 6, 8, and 10. What was different about the odd-numbered weeks? Each week, Bateson replaced the notice on the cupboard that reminded people to pay for their drinks. The text detailing the prices of coffee, tea, and milk was identical, but she changed the small decorative picture at the top of the notice. For the 5 odd-numbered weeks, Bateson downloaded photos from the internet showing different pairs of watching eyes. Honesty levels soared. During even-numbered weeks, she printed pictures of different flowers, daisies, marigolds, roses. Honesty plummeted. Office workers were later quizzed about the notice. People shook their heads, mystified. No one had noticed the photo was different from week to week. Yet this subtle change produced a giant effect on honesty. When Bateson subtly communicated that people were being watched, even if the eyes were only a grainy image downloaded from the internet, people were far more honest than when they poured their coffee in the company of marigolds. You could draw a small lesson and a large lesson from this experiment. The small lesson is that a picture showing a pair of eyes with a penetrating gaze seems to make people more honest in their private actions than a picture showing daisies. The big lesson is that people are powerfully influenced by things that they never consciously register. The workers did not notice the photographs, yet they were influenced by them. Why did people fail to notice that marigolds had been replaced by a photo showing a pair of eyes? Think about it this way. Your attention is like a spotlight that can illuminate anything you choose to focus on. But the spotlight can't illuminate everything at the same time. If you are thinking about work or an office conversation, you might not notice that the photograph on the wall shows a pair of eyes or a flower. If you remember to pay attention to the decor, you don't notice it is bright outside, and people have been shown to give larger tips make more aggressive investments, and generally report more optimism about their lives and romantic relationships when it is bright and sunny, compared to when it is overcast. In fact, if you were to make a detailed inventory of everything you could possibly focus on at any given moment, the list would run to dozens of pages. There are smells and tastes, ideas, moods, and tones of voice. Focusing on any one thing is trivial. Focusing on everything at the same time is impossible. If you really did sit down to make that inventory, you would see that at any given moment, you are not aware of most of the cues around you. Right now, for example, you are listening to and thinking about these words. But until I remind you about it, you are not paying attention to the design of the CD package, or the iPod you're playing it on, or whether the temperature is right. You can, of course, refocus the beam of your attention on anything, but doing so means something else will disappear from the spotlight. What happens to things that are outside the spotlight of our conscious attention? They don't vanish altogether, because this would be dangerous. It would be irritating to be reminded about your peripheral vision all the time, because much of the time nothing important is happening there. But you want to be notified about important things. So as the spotlight of your conscious attention moves to other things, your hidden brain remains vigilant to your peripheral vision. In situations that do not require conscious intervention, the hidden brain simply responds to what it sees without informing you about what it has done. When it comes to a notice posted on a cupboard, the hidden brain notices the small picture on the notice has changed from week to week. Since the hidden brain specializes in rapid analysis and lacks the sophistication to distinguish between a photograph and an actual pair of eyes, it subtly prompts you to behave as if you were really being watched. The irresistible heuristic. A few thousand miles from Newcastle, another experiment was underway at the same time Melissa Bateson was tracking her beverage station. Economists have long puzzled over how investors deal with new entrants to the stock market. There is no mystery. When it comes to a well-known company such as Google going public, investors know a lot about such companies. But in many cases, new stocks are volatile because investors are still learning about companies. Rumors about internal company developments and earnings can send prices spiraling upward or can trigger a rush for the exit. Mathematicians have come up with complicated formulas to track changes and have developed algorithms to predict minute decimal shifts in share prices. When billions of dollars of stock are traded each day, small differences mean enormous profits and losses. Psychologists Adam Alter and Daniel Oppenheimer recently decided to try their hand at this game. Did they study the complexities of the stock exchange, the underlying strength of companies and oil futures? No, no, and no. Did they have vast encyclopedic knowledge of where the economy was headed? Nope. Did they have insider information? Decidedly not. The psychologists looked at whether companies had names that were pronounceable or names that were unpronounceable. They presented a group of volunteers with a series of made-up company names that would wrap your tongue in knots. Ageadux and Zajibdan, Mextiscri and Bolioaks, as well as a set of company names that were easy to pronounce, such as Gilman and Clearman, Barnings and Tanley. If the companies Keown and Alumnius were like complex paintings from Vincent van Gogh's Dark Period, full of dark skies and menacing colors, the companies Adderley and Dearbond were like paintings brought home from school by happy five-year-olds, a yellow sun with a smiley face peering down on a house with a puff of smoke coming out of the chimney. Alter and Oppenheimer found that without their awareness, volunteers were influenced by the names of companies they studied. They tended to overvalue companies with easy names and undervalue companies with difficult names. But surely names would not affect how companies fared on the real stock market. What sane investor would base investment decisions on names? Alter and Oppenheimer tracked 10 stocks with easy-to-pronounce names and 10 stocks with hard-to-pronounce names on the New York Stock Exchange. They found that companies with easy-to-pronounce names outperformed companies with hard-to-pronounce names by 11.2% on their very first day of trading. After 6 months, the difference was more than 27%. After a year, it was more than 33%. If you'd put $1 million into the stocks with easy names and $1 million into the stocks with hard names, the group with easy names would have outperformed the group with difficult names by $330,000. It got better, or worse, depending on your point of view. Instead of looking at names, Alter and Oppenheimer looked at companies' ticker symbols. A review of share prices on the New York Stock Exchange and the American Stock Exchange showed that companies with easy-to-pronounce stock ticker codes, such as KAR, outperformed companies with hard-to-pronounce ticker codes, such as RDO, by 8.5% on their first day of trading and by more than 2% after 1 year of trading. Remember the mathematicians who track the market? They get excited by differences in decimal points. 2 percentage points is big money. Alter and Oppenheimer found the pronounceability effect went away with time. Once investors learn about the companies, they start basing decisions on more important things than names. Pronounceability matters only until investors develop proficiency in the skills that really matter. But why would investors base their initial decisions on something as trivial as a name? Unlike with the office workers in Newcastle, you don't have to ask whether investors were aware that they were being influenced by the names of companies. They were not. If they'd known about the bias, they would have compensated for it, and the difference in stock performance would have vanished. Like the beverage drinkers in Newcastle, the investors that Alter and Oppenheimer studied felt they were making deliberate choices. Without their awareness, however, their decisions were swayed. Their hidden brains associated the names of companies that were easy to pronounce with a sense of comfort, and the names of companies that were difficult to pronounce with a sense of discomfort. Comfort is linked to familiarity and safety, which is why investors chose some stocks and drove up the prices. Discomfort is associated with risk and unfamiliarity, which is why investors avoided those stocks and undervalued them. Applying heuristics, shortcuts linking comfort with safety and discomfort with risk, to situations for which they have not been designed, is a recipe for trouble. The three-legged race. I recently typed Indikrama 142 Heerlen 6412 p.m. into Google Earth. I saw the planet on my screen slowly spin. The Atlantic Ocean passed by in half a second. England was a blip, the English Channel a droplet of water on the side of my glass. Cities and local landmarks emerged, and I zoomed in on trees, roads, and cars in the town of Heerlen in the Netherlands. Google Earth didn't tell me this, but the rooftop on my computer screen was an IKEA store. Across from the IKEA was an Applebee's restaurant with about 30 tables inside. The restaurant was family-friendly, casual, and moderately priced. Inside the restaurant, a waitress took orders. She was about 17 or 18 years old. When customers asked for beer and fries, the waitress wrote down the order and repeated it verbatim. "Bier," she echoed, "or friet." When other customers asked for beer, the waitress said pils, a Dutch synonym for beer. For friet, she said patat, another synonym. She wrote down every order. For one group of customers, the waitress mimicked the customers verbatim. For another group, she acknowledged their orders by using a synonym and saying yes. Tips given by the customers were counted. When the waitress mimicked customers, her tip went up. The difference was not trivial. On average, customers who were mimicked gave the waitress tips that were 140% larger. The waitress did not know the aim of the experiment, so it was not as though she treated one set of customers better than the other. I called Dutch psychologist Rick van Baren, who conducted the study. He told me mimicry works best when it follows the natural rhythms of conversation. If you instantly repeat what someone tells you, will be obvious and irritating, like a 5-year-old repeating back to you everything you say. But when you repeat what you hear after a short delay, you communicate something important. I am listening to you. I have understood you. I agree with you. What is fascinating is that the waitress communicated exactly those things to the other customers too. By using synonyms and saying yes, she told these customers that she had heard them and understood their instructions. By writing down every order, she emphasized that she would accurately communicate the orders to kitchen staff. But language is more than just verbal information. Much of what we say goes beyond the literal meaning of the words we use. Using tone, inflection, and various patterns of speech, we communicate affection, anger, and gratitude, loneliness, and longing. I'm not drawing your attention to the well-known difference between verbal and non-verbal communication. I'm drawing your attention to the difference between conscious and unconscious communication. Without their awareness, customers who were mimicked felt they received better service. The next time you're in a park, a restaurant, or an office, watch any two people talking. The more in sync they are, the more likely they will be to subtly mimic each other. If you get close enough to hear what they are saying, you might hear them repeating each other's phrases. They might even have the same rhythms of speech, the same body language. Their hidden brains are prompting them to reflect concordance. When people hear something they agree with, they respond enthusiastically and quickly. When they hear something they disagree with, they are microseconds slower to respond, because the hidden brain knows that an impasse lies ahead and is girding for conflict. The psychologists Tanya Chartrand and John Barg once videotaped people in conversation with a lab assistant. The assistant was instructed to rub her face or shake her foot throughout the conversation. The videotape revealed the subjects of the study rubbing their faces and shaking their feet in response. When quizzed later on, none of the people remembered adopting these tics, nor did they report noticing the assistant's face rubbing and foot shaking. Unlike psychologists who deliberately manipulate behavior to see what effect it has on others, most of our modulations in speech and action happen unconsciously and unintentionally in the course of everyday communication. I unconsciously respond to your unconscious signals and you to mine. The fact that neither of us is aware of this dance does not mean it is irrelevant. Remember, even as the Applebee's customers and the waitress were exchanging information at a deliberate and explicit level, orders and acknowledgements for beer and fries, they were also exchanging information at an unconscious and unintentional level. If you looked only at the explicit information exchanged, you would not understand why some customers gave extra generous tips. When we hear about the Newcastle beverage station or the volunteers who rub their faces and shake their feet in response to a lab assistant's actions, or an eyewitness who makes an obvious error, we can't help but feel we would never be susceptible to such manipulation. Of course, we would notice that the person sitting before us was shaking her foot or rubbing her face. The photo obviously shows a pair of eyes one week and marigolds the next. The rapist's teeth are straight, the suspect's are crooked. The cues are not hidden. When Dutch psychologist Rick van Baaren came up with his Applebee's experiment, the waitress was initially reluctant to participate because she felt the mimicry would be obvious. Customers would ask her what the hell she thought she was doing. Of course, no one did. What the restaurant experiment reveals is that your hidden brain does not work in isolation. It forms networks with other hidden brains. I unconsciously pick up the unconscious cues you send me, and I unconsciously respond to them. Without being aware of it, we are constantly adapting to different contexts and people, modulating not just our rhythms of speech, but the very content of our ideas. This effect is especially powerful in situations where people are trying to form emotional connections. When you want to create a bond with another person, your hidden brain subtly whispers, "Say this," or "Don't say that."